The Short Stories of Vladimir Nabokov, taken from Nabokov's Dozen, a collection of 13 stories, Doubleday and Company, Garden City, New York, 1958. Vladimir Nabokov once remarked, "While I keep everything on the very brink of parody, there must be, on the other hand, an abyss of seriousness." The interplay of solemnity and humor in his work underscores the double-edged nature of life, which contains elements of both comedy and pathos. In addition, Nabokov's vagueness about time and place hurls his readers into a fractured and unreal world. That in Aleppo once. "Although I can produce documentary proofs of matrimony," V's friend wrote him in a letter, "I am positive now that my wife never existed." They had married, the letter continued, not long before the gentle Germans thundered into France. The groom was a journalist, and his criticisms of the Nazi regime were sure to breed trouble, so the couple wanted to flee to New York, where the bride's uncle lived. But they could not get proper immigration papers, and so were forced to settle for a move to Nice. His wife greatly mourned the loss of their dog, which they were obliged to leave behind. "The honesty of her grief shocked me," he wrote, "as we never had any dog." The newlyweds traveled by train, stopping along the way at the city of Forgères. Unfortunately, while he was in the station buying food, the train left without him. He sent frantic messages to all the stops between Forgères and Nice, to no avail. After several months, he finally found his wife in Marseille. They were enormously relieved to be together again, and promptly began the long, tortuous process of applying for visas to America. In the meantime, he tried to get his wife to tell him what had transpired during the time they were separated. She told him several tales. They all differed wildly. According to one story, she had taken up with a group of refugees and found shelter at a Russian church. Later, she claimed that she had met a traveling salesman who abducted her and took advantage of her. In still another version, she told how she'd run off with the salesman of her own accord. On the day their visas were issued, he arrived at their apartment to discover that she had disappeared with all of her belongings. He made a few inquiries, all without success. He did run into an elderly acquaintance who berated him for having done away with the dog back in Paris. Despondent, he took a boat to America. On board, he encountered a doctor who claimed to have known his wife in Marseille. The doctor said she had told him about her husband, who was planning to meet her shortly with their bags and visas. "It was at that moment," read the letter's final paragraph, "that I suddenly knew for certain that she had never existed at all." Her uncle's address in New York, he later ascertained, was no more than an alley between two buildings. Still, sometimes he had the desire to look for her. At the same time, he feared to make the attempt. "It may end in Aleppo if I'm not careful," he closed. The war was raging on, and Aleppo was a dangerous place to be. Scenes from the life of a double monster. Floyd was trying to resolve a question that he and his brother had been asked years ago. Could they recollect, the doctor had once asked, the very first time either of them realized the peculiarity of their condition and destiny? Floyd and Lloyd had been born conjoined twins and were wed forever at their navels. They had shared the same umbilical cord in the womb. Their mother had died immediately after their birth, shocked beyond measure by their condition, Floyd conjectured, and were left to be raised by their grandfather, Ibrahim. After thinking it over, Floyd remembered that by the age of 3 or 4, he had started wondering about his strange relationship with his brother. By the age of 9, he decided, "I knew quite clearly that Lloyd and I presented the rarest of freaks." Soon Grandfather Ibrahim began exhibiting them for money. Floyd had never felt shame or revulsion at his condition. However, the first time he ever saw another child, a normal child, a child other than Lloyd, that is, Floyd concluded that he must be a person with two shadows. He reflected on the strangeness of it all. He and the other child both cast shadows in the sun, but Floyd possessed yet another shadow, a palpable reflection of my corporal self. And looking on at the awestruck boy who stood gazing at the conjoined twins, Floyd merely wondered if the boy had somehow managed to lose his shadow, or had unhooked it and left it at home. Linked, Lloyd and Floyd were complete and normal. He was neither. The twins, though unashamed, lived in fear of one person, their uncle Novus. They knew that he was determined to steal them from their grandfather and sell them to a showman or a carnival. So one day, thinking they had little time left to enjoy themselves, they decided to visit the Black Sea. They had lived near its shores their entire lives, but had never seen it. This was their only chance to do what we were absolutely forbidden to do, go beyond a certain picket fence, open a certain gate. But as they emerged from a stand of cypress trees onto the beach, they saw Uncle Novus waiting for them with his carriage. They tried to flee, but he easily snatched them up and pitched them into a large box. They would never again see their home. Now, 20 years later, Floyd thought back on the moment of their abduction. Had some adventurous mariner stepped out on the shore just then, would he have experienced the thrilling trace of some ancient enchantment as he confronted the gentle two-headed mythological monster framed by cypress and white stone? But alas, Floyd reminisced, there was nobody to greet us there save our nervous kidnapper, a small, doll-faced man wearing cheap spectacles. Conversation Piece, 1945. I have a disreputable namesake, the writer began, complete from nickname to surname, a man whom I have never seen in the flesh, but whose vulgar personality I have been able to deduce from his chance intrusions into the castle of my life. The writer's double did indeed seem to be both real and disreputable. For example, in Nice once, a young woman called on the writer at his hotel, took one look at him, apologized, and left. The writer also learned that his double had once borrowed, and never returned, a copy of the Protocols of the Wise Men of Zion, a fraudulent document whose only use was to incite anti-Semitic pogroms. And while lecturing in Zurich, the writer had been arrested in a restaurant for the other man's crime of violence, smashing 3 mirrors. After emigrating to the United States, the writer thought he had escaped his evil twin. But one month, he had received a phone call. A woman's voice on the other end invited him to attend a lecture about the war. The caller had assured him that he would be very, very much interested in the discussion. Yes, when he attended the lecture, he found that he was interested, but also deeply disgusted. The lecturer, a Dr. Schu, made apology after apology for German atrocities committed against the Jews, but then turned around and equated those atrocities to the Allied bombing of Leipzig, Munich, and Dresden. When the writer could stand no more, he retrieved his coat and galoshes and stormed out, but not before he had announced to his hostess, "You are either murderers or fools or both, and that man is a filthy German agent." A week later, he received a letter. "Esteemed sir, you have been pursuing me all my life. Good friends of mine, after reading your books, have turned away from me, thinking that I was the author of those depraved, decadent writings. In 1941, and again in 1943, I was arrested in France by the Germans for things I had never said or thought. Now, in America, not content with having caused me all sorts of troubles in other countries, you have the arrogance to impersonate me and to appear in a drunken condition at the house of a highly respected person. This I will not tolerate. I could have you jailed and branded as an impostor, but I suppose you would not like that. And so I suggest that by way of indemnity..." The amount demanded was actually quite modest. Time and ebb. A 90-year-old scientist had survived a disease that he and everyone else thought would kill him, and now he was resolved to write his memoirs. He discovered, however, that while his early memories were remarkably clear, his recent recall was frustratingly confused. "I cannot," he scrawled, "remember the name of the eminent scientist who attacked my latest paper, just as I have also forgotten those other names which my equally eminent defenders called him." Stymied by this phenomenon, he decided to content himself with contrasting the world of his childhood with the world of his old age. He was born a Jew in Paris, but his family had fled to the United States to avoid the tortures another nation had inflicted upon his race. He remembered thinking that the skyscrapers of New York were quaintly misnamed. To his childish eyes, they did not grate against the sky at all, but seemed to merge delicately and serenely into the sunset, their pulsating lights merging softly with the twilight. As a child, he had also been fascinated by airplanes, though he doubted anyone born since the 1970s would remember them as fondly as he did. There was such a romance about them in those early days. A boy would know planes from propeller spinner to rudder trim tab, he recalled, and could distinguish the species by the pattern of exhaust flames in the darkness. One of his most cherished boyhood experiences was imitating the drone of an engine as he watched a plane approach, growing larger as it roared overhead. Then slowly it would shrink into the distance until nothing but a lone star remained in the sky, like an asterisk leading to an undiscoverable footnote. Tragicomedy is Nabokov's stage. Timelessness is a major component in his fiction. Consider the newlyweds in That in Aleppo Once. At the beginning of the story, we chuckle at the thought of a man deducing that his wife never existed. As we read on, however, the story turns to tragedy when we comprehend that she is a woman who in fact physically exists and lives in a web of lies and deceit. A similar development occurs in Scenes from the Life of a Double Monster. Initially, it is amusing when Floyd says that the first child he ever saw was neither complete nor normal. But the mild humor is transformed into pathos when we learn that the conjoined twins have previously been abducted by their uncle, sold to strangers, and made to live out their lives under the gawking eyes of circus goers. Conversation piece 1945 also stretches the limits of credibility. A writer is haunted by an apparent double throughout his life. Finally, he is contacted by this disreputable doppelganger, who has likewise been troubled by the antics of the writer. Time and Ebb is a more tender and melancholy story. An aged scholar writing his memoirs, perhaps in an attempt to liberate himself from the painful thoughts of his own mortality, becomes lost in reverie about the early days of flying machines. In the end, he leaves his readers in a state of wistful reminiscence, in much the same way as he was left behind by his vanishing airplane.